He's back.
From the studios of Wavefront Audiovisual Engineering in Schenectady, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, crime, greed, corruption, and all the wonderful things that happen when you mix them together. Like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode 44 of Little Brother, dated the 24th of July, 2021. Stay tuned. Little Brother is right around the corner. As always, I'd like to remind everybody that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants and not necessarily those of anyone else who may, for whatever reason, attempt to claim them. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request airtime for a rebuttal. So let's get started. At the start of July, 2,600 meetings resumed normal operation in 13 cities across the U.S. These gatherings, long a cornerstone of hacker and maker social life, had been officially suspended since the start of the pandemic for the safety of the community. Some 2,600 groups chose to meet virtually using tools such as Zoom or Jitsi to gather online in video conference calls. However, virtual gatherings lacked the hands-on nature of bringing, collaborating, and sharing works in progress. Meetings were permitted to resume in places where the population at large was at least 40% vaccinated, and participants are asked to only attend if they have been vaccinated themselves. It seems as though Microsoft had been having a really rough week or two. Last week, it was Print Nightmare, a vulnerability that takes advantage of the Print Spooler service to gain control of a computer running any of several of their Windows operating systems. It was enough of a concern for Microsoft that they took the unusual twin steps of issuing an update for Windows XP despite it now being 12 years past the end of mainstream support, and of releasing a patch immediately rather than following their traditional approach of issuing patches on Tuesdays. For many, the better solution has been to disable the Print Spooler unless you actually need it. This was immediately followed by another vulnerability appearing on systems where shadow copy is enabled, in which backup copies of the password database become accessible to unprivileged users. Home users are generally unaffected by this second issue, but it is likely to cause headaches in corporate IT. On the other hand, maybe Microsoft are starting to understand the problem. In a move that few in our community would have expected a decade ago, Microsoft have quietly released a Linux distribution. The distribution, called CBL Mariner, is a lightweight distribution that seems poised to take over for CentOS in Microsoft's Azure cloud computing environment. While its existence in this context was already known, the newsworthy component is that the distribution has now been published on GitHub, making it available to anyone with a little Linux know-how to download and install locally. As with CentOS, it's an RPM-based distribution, in this case using the TinyDNF package manager. On July 14th, the maintainers of the Kiwi SDR software-defined radio system published an update. Under normal circumstances, this wouldn't have been anything exceptional, but in this case, the author took advantage of the update to quietly remove a backdoor into the deployed Kiwi SDR systems, which would have allowed an attacker to take full control of the node with root privileges. It appears that the backdoor has been in the software since at least 2017. As of the 19th, unpatched receivers are being refused access to the aggregator operated by the maintainers of the software, effectively taking those systems offline. The commit note in GitHub simply states, "Bug fixes." The Center for Internet Security is reporting that there are multiple vulnerabilities in Google's Chrome web browser. These vulnerabilities can allow an attacker to run arbitrary code on a machine afflicted with these vulnerabilities, which appear to consist mostly of a number of commonly found coding errors. It isn't clear from the report Whether the issues are confined to Chrome itself, or if the issue also extends to Chromium, Microsoft Edge, Opera, or Brave, all of which use the same core code base as Chrome. Meanwhile, Firefox, which uses its own code base, different from the others, is not left untouched. CIS issued another alert a few days prior, listing a similar set of issues with that browser. The general advice, as always, is to keep your software patched and mind where you browse. In an apparent backlash to Silicon Valley's attempts to maintain safety and civility online, a Wyoming company called Freedom Phone has started to sell telephones equipped with a customized version of the Android operating system called Freedom OS, which comes preloaded with a number of apps favored by the political right, which have had issues maintaining a presence on the Apple and Google App Stores. The App Store native to Freedom OS is described by the phone maker as uncensorable. The phone, which retails for around $500, appears to be a rebranded Yumadigi A9 Pro, a highly customizable Taiwanese-made phone based on MediaTek hardware. The Yumadigi normally sells for around $120 and is known to be vulnerable to bootloader attacks. And those are the headlines. You're listening to Little Brother. What does Amazon Web Service have in common with content distribution network Akamai? Well, it seems like both of them employ a guy named Ralph because both of them have broken the internet in the past couple of weeks. On July 12th, Amazon Web Services, a hosting provider that provides compute, storage, and web hosting services, amongst other things, for tens of thousands of organizations worldwide, suffered an outage, taking out a large chunk of the services we use to connect via the internet. Not to be outdone, Akamai, by way of a botched DNS entry, took out all of the websites that they front. Now, one of the great promises of the internet has always been that it sees censorship as damage and routes around it. Unfortunately, this logic relies on a premise that the internet routes around damage. In some ways, it does. When there's damage in the middle of the network, it can get a message from point A to point B, come hell or high water. This is great when performance is not important, but we've reached a point where we are sending real-time audio and video and expecting it to arrive timely. When the internet has to route around damage, be it inflicted by sensors or saboteurs or accidental, it becomes slow and jittery, making it unusable for these purposes. But that's not even what happened here. In the case of both Akamai and AWS, we have increasing amounts of content under the control of a decreasing number of providers in the interest of saving money. Well, this didn't work out so well for broadcast or cable TV media. As web services have converged on the same pattern, I would expect we're going to see more of these types of mass failures. Pegasus is a spyware package developed by an Israeli company called the NSO Group, which deals in cyber arms. Pegasus is reputed to be able to infect most current releases of Android and iOS, so if you use a cell phone as we all do, you could be attacked using this particular software. The only solace we can take is that most of us are not interesting enough to bother with. What makes this important, though, is that if spyware is deployed on a device, there's nothing that device can be trusted to keep private. You could be using the most secure messaging platform out there, but because the operating system has access to the device and Pegasus has access to the operating system, Pegasus has access to your messages. It's just that simple. Mind you, this isn't a reason not to use such applications. Just understand the limitations that they face in trying to keep your information secure. Pegasus is primarily marketed to governments. Its application in basic spycraft is pretty clear. Governments have been spying since time immemorial. However, the story of Pegasus spyware has taken something of a very dark turn. Its existence was discovered in 2018 when an attempt was made to target a human rights activist, and the installation went wrong. Well, around this time last year, Haaretz uncovered that the NSO Group had made hundreds of millions of U.S. dollars selling the spyware to a number of Gulf states, which were used to surveil journalists, activists, and political leaders. This month, the Pegasus Project, a collaboration by over 80 journalists from 17 organizations, with the technical support of Amnesty International, conducted cutting-edge forensics tests to identify traces of the spyware. The technical details are laid out on Amnesty's website. Amongst the things that were found out is that the family of Jamal Khashoggi were targeted. This is hardly surprising, given that he was himself targeted for assassination. French President Emmanuel Macron was also targeted. Here in the U.S., we have it enshrined in the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution that individuals won't be spied on by our government. Other nations may have similar protections in place. Ignoring for the moment how foolish it would be to expect these laws to simply be followed, it doesn't bind foreign governments in any way at all. Now, so far, I've only talked about government applications of the spyware. To my knowledge, there is no reason to believe that it isn't available to anyone willing to pay for it. And that should give you nightmares. On July 3rd or so, the internet freaked out. Yeah, I know. This happens all the time, but in this case, it happened over a piece of software that's very near and dear to me, one that I've been using for a very long time, and one that is indispensable in making this podcast. That would be the free and open source audio editor, Audacity. Now, I won't lie. I participated in the freakout myself. The headline that appeared on Reddit and posted initially to rlinux and later cross-posted to numerous other subreddits, including rdjs, where I caught up with it, stated, Audacity may collect data necessary for law enforcement, litigation, and authorities requests, if any, according to new privacy notice. And it contained a link to the offensive text. Now, I did not at the time have the good sense to copy the offensive privacy notice, but it seems like it was a good example of how not to take on management of an open source software project. The offensive excerpt, however, was quoted in some of the discussions, and it read in part, "All your personal data is stored on our servers in the European Economic Area. However, we are occasionally required to share your personal data with our main office in Russia and our external counsel in the USA." Now, in retrospect, this is actually not all that out of the ordinary for a privacy policy. The maintainers are in Europe, they have offices in Russia, they have lawyers in the US. Both Russia and the U.S. have got ways to compel compliance that aren't particularly pleasant, so it's clear to see how this point would be necessary in their privacy policy. While Muse software is under the jurisdiction of the GDPR, they also are under the jurisdiction of the U.S. and Russian law, and so they're caught between a rock and a hard place. In all likelihood, a conflict would lead to them deciding, possibly on a case-by-case basis and definitely with the help of legal counsel, what law to comply with when there's a conflict of some sort. Now, for all other purposes, any data they might collect is protected by the GDPR, which makes it generally quite a bit safer than it might be if it were stored here in the U.S. But the phrase that I think threw the internet the most into a tizzy was personal data. What are they collecting? Indeed, why were they collecting anything at all? Well, Muse Group, to their credit, actually responded pretty quickly. On July 7th, they issued a statement on their GitHub repository that read in part, "We believe the concerns are due largely to unclear phrasing in the privacy policy, which we are now in the process of rectifying. In the meantime, we would like to clarify what seem to be the major points of concern. We do not and will not sell any data we collect or share it with third parties, full stop. Data we collect is very limited, consisting of IP address, basic system info, error report data. We don't collect any additional data beyond the points listed for any purpose, and we won't collect or provide any information other than the data described above with any government agency or law enforcement agency. It isn't shared on agency requests. We only do so if we're compelled by a court order in a jurisdiction that we serve." Basically, what I'm seeing is that there is no there. And to put a final nail in the coffin of this concern, a new privacy policy was posted 2 days ago, which much more clearly states the reasons and notes the ability to opt out of data collections. This was accompanied by an apology posted to GitHub, which reads in part, "We accept that certain clauses in the old privacy policy were worded in a way that begged for misinterpretation." You think, Skippy? "We hope that we have sufficiently demonstrated that very little data is actually collected and that you have full control over whether or not that data is sent, and that was already the case before the story received any media attention. we'd like to repeat our apology for the confusion. In short, like so many freakouts, this was a tempest in a teapot. Audacity users have nothing to fear from Mother Russia or Uncle Sam that they didn't already have. All of the concerns about Audacity suddenly becoming Russian spyware? Well, maybe Vladimir Putin put it best.
You're much talked about in America. There's much conversation, more so than
Maybe they have nothing else to do in America but talk about me.
No.
We had nothing better to do. Now, some of you are probably wondering why this is episode 44 and not episode 1. The music you're hearing right now is Space Debris by Captain Image, which was the original theme music to Little Brother. Yours truly was a participant in a movement in the 90s and early aughties called the Low Power FM Movement, which sought to make radio broadcasting more accessible to communities by making it possible to do with smaller radio stations running smaller budgets, simplifying the licensing requirements, and putting the cost of those requirements within the reach of community organizations such as collectives, places of worship, etc. In some cases, this meant lobbying. In other cases, it meant acts of civil disobedience, such as operating a pirate radio station, which I don't know anything about. One of the groups involved in the Low Power FM movement was the AInfos Radio Project and its website, radioforall.net, which, I might add, still stands, which provided a platform for independent radio programs to be syndicated to low power and community radio stations. So, I created Little Brother and I syndicated it. In 2000, on a whim, I produced the first episode of Little Brother as a news bulletin type of program and posted it to radioforall.net. It was, at first, a monthly production. After 5 episodes, with the help and at the suggestion of my good friend Frater Llewellyn, I was able to get a regular weekly slot on local radio station WRPI, which at the time was operating as a community radio station. Students at the hosting university ran the station, got first pick of time slots, but unclaimed slots were available to members of the surrounding community, so I signed up. From there until episode 43, Little Brother took the form of a panel discussion show, with panelists coming and going at random, but with 3 regulars, Thongaboo, Phil, and Lil. Collins were welcome as well, and often greeted with exclamations of, "Look out," or "Good Lord," from Lil. In addition to WRPI, there were at least 8 radio stations that I know of where Little Brother could be heard, including an English language station in Okinawa. At the end of the semester in May 2002, when the station was starting to plan its summer season, I decided to hang it up, and roughly 18 years have passed, always with the thought in mind that I might restart the project. There was even some discussion of passing the torch to Phil or of moving the show to community television. However, we never really took those ideas anywhere. And that brings us to here. I appreciate your listening to this extremely long overdue episode 44. I don't know what the lifespan of this project will be in this incarnation, but I appreciate you coming along for the ride. Until 2 days ago, I had believed episodes 1 through 43 to be lost to history. However, a pair of CDs turned up with some modest quality MP3s on most of the episodes, most of which were recorded from the radio, and I have posted them on this show's website, littlebrotherpodcast.com, for your listening enjoyment. If you want to go back and listen to the past episodes, I recommend first listening to episode 43 so you can hear where we're coming from now, and then go back to listen to the older episodes because there's a big difference as the show evolved. I want to leave you with one last thing. As I mentioned, panelists came and went more or less randomly, and sometimes they just didn't work out. One such panelist was named Colum. And after the episode in which he appeared, a listener known as Drayok took the samples of the show and made music out of it. And so, I present to you, Colum's Revenge.
is a show about technology.
I've got a steel plate in my head. I've got a steel plate in my head.
There's a first aid kit in the next room.
Little Brother is produced, recorded, edited, and hosted by yours truly, Chuck Ritter. Special thanks to Fongaboo and the crowd at Helix for web hosting support. Shout out to the Albany 2600 group, with special thanks to Azriel and to Mystere73 for providing several good story leads, and to Lotus for somehow providing exactly the right piece of audio equipment at exactly the moment I needed it. Music used in this episode was Adrenochrome by Super Action 80, Space Debris by Captain Image, Column's Revenge by Dreok, and our theme music is Around Chaos by Heatseeker. Join us next week when Little Brother tells on Big Brother once again. Stay safe and be well.